In Carl Safina's new book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel, he writes about elephant families as they navigate the pervasive drought and incidents of poaching in Kenya's national parks. He sees a free-living wolf pack sort out the aftermath of tragedy in Yellowstone National Park and plunges into an astonishingly peaceful society of killer whales living in the waters of the Pacific Northwest. These animals are treated as the individual characters they are, with distinct personalities and unique roles within social structures, not unlike our own. Taking us into the animals' lives and minds, Safina reports on the surprising similarities between our minds and theirs, while tackling issues that affect all of us, including habitat conservation and extinction. Carl Safina is the author of 7 books and is founding president of the Safina Center at Stony Brook University, where he also co-chairs the university's Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. He also hosts Saving the Ocean on PBS. His new book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. It is published by Henry Holt, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Carl Safina to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Very nice to have you here. What brought you down this path of looking at making these connections between us and animals and that idea of beyond words, of the thinking and the feeling?
Well, first of all, I've always, since I was a very small child, I've always been interested simply in what do animals do and why do they do it. And nowadays, of course, we have a problem with animals, and that is that we are driving them off the face of the earth, really. We have a great extinction crisis going on. Elephants are getting slaughtered. All this stuff is happening. And I wanted to show not only what is at stake, which is usually how we talk about conservation, but I wanted to step back a bit and show who is at stake and what their lives are like and who is on this planet with us. And that's what I wanted to show in this book.
Isn't it safe to say that we're all at stake? Is it safe to say that we're all at stake?
I'm sorry, you dropped out a second. Can you repeat that?
Sure. Is it safe to say that we're all at stake in some way, shape, or form?
Well, in some way, shape, or form, yes, but humans are not endangered with extinction. And what we are endangering ourselves with, I think, is a depauperization of the world. We're draining the world of a lot of its living vitality and its beauty, and simply the room that allows people to have human dignity and have what they need. So we are not only crowding other animals literally out of existence, but I think we're crowding ourselves out of the opportunity for a truly dignified future for literally billions of people on the planet. Now, you know, I'm not talking about people who live in New York State who are part of the most advanced society in the world ever. I'm talking about a lot of people who have no opportunity, no ability to get education, who live on $10 a day or less, which is about 60% of the world's population, and we're making that harder and worse for ourselves.
When you think of one of the things that you write about, which I find fascinating, is how humans and I mentioned this in the introduction, and the social structures are so similar to other animals that live in stable, structured groups. Give us examples of that and what we should ultimately understand from that parallel.
Well, I'll jump right to what we should ultimately understand, and then I'll circle back a little bit. We can see that these animals try very hard to stay alive. They try very hard to keep their babies alive. They know who their friends are. They know who their enemies are. They seek status. They depose their rivals. Their lives follow the arc of a career. And in many ways, their lives are very, very vivid. Most of them have senses and perceptions that are much more acute than ours. So they're not just blundering around out there. They're living lives, and they mean something to one another. If an elephant family loses its matriarch, their survival goes down a lot because they've lost the leader who understands where the last remaining food and water is in case of a drought. She remembers that from 20 years ago when she followed her leader. And so these animals, they're not just, you know, they're not just out there moving around. They're leading lives, and they're trying very hard to stay alive. And there are many, many parallels between them and us that I think are important to understand and to appreciate.
You write in the book about when it comes to how we live, that human senses have ultimately been dulled by civilization, and our brain size, you report, has actually been reduced. Compare that to animals who are alert, have ultra-fast response times, and physical abilities that we could not imagine.
Yes, that's right. And as we learned how to settle in villages and cope with more crowded conditions and lead more static lives, and we brought other animals in and domesticated them and bred in domestication the strains of animals that were coping well with crowding and were easy to manage and not too uppity, we were inadvertently doing the same thing to ourselves. We were bringing in these animals and saying, we're all going to live here. It's going to be crowded. You're going to have to just stay calm. And the ones that couldn't cope with that, we did not breed and we did not allow them to continue. And as we forced them to settle into more confined, more settled conditions, we were forcing ourselves to do that. So we inadvertently seem to have domesticated ourselves to a significant enough degree that our brains are 10% smaller than Neanderthal brains and about 10% smaller than the brains of the earliest Homo sapiens 100,000 years ago. A little humbling.
It is very humbling. And do you think it will further change? I mean, is it...
Sure. It certainly could. I mean, the evolutionary pressures are always around. Some of them are pressures to, you know, become a lot sharper, and this idea of the survival of the fittest. What that really is supposed to mean is the ones that fit best in the conditions. It doesn't mean the fittest ones to run marathons. It doesn't mean the ones that are stronger or more physically fit or more mentally fit. It means the ones that work best in the conditions. And there is always these kinds of pressures swirling around. Now, with civilization and culture, a lot of those pressures have relaxed, lost direction, gone one way, gone another way. But the idea that we are perfected post-evolutionary, purely cultural beings is not correct. We are cultural beings, but we still are subject to, you know, what works best and what doesn't. And the measure of what works best is who has the most children that get to survive. That's always the measure of it. And with people, it used to be, you know, the best hunters, the very smartest ones, the ones who could really lead. They were the most successful. That's not really always the case right now. And, you know, a lot of times it's the ones who can just get along, go along, not get too upset about things, be more tractable, be more conforming, that kind of thing. So, and if you look around, a lot of the very, very smartest people have the fewest children. So the evolutionary pressures we're putting ourselves are pretty counterintuitive.
You also talk about in the book about species that have the most complex societies develop the most complex brains.
Yes, and the most what we would call intelligence, which is the most flexible approach to solving problems. It used to be thought for a long time that intelligence probably had a lot to do with how difficult it is to get food. If the harder it is to get food, the more intelligent you have to be. But it doesn't really seem like that's the way it works in the rest of the animal kingdom. It seems that the ones that live in complicated social groups are the most intelligent. A good example of that is elephants. Elephants eat grass and shrubbery, and wildebeest and cows and goats eat the same thing. But elephants are much more intelligent. They live in much more complicated and structured social groups. They really have to understand who's who. They have to carry these relationships across many years, in many cases decades. And a goat doesn't have to do that.
You, as I mentioned, the subtitle of the book is What Animals Think and Feel. And you do talk about the capacity for grief that animals have, and then actually that we as humans share that with animals in many respects.
Yeah, we share a lot of things with other animals because we get a lot of our emotional capacity from other animals in earlier stages in evolution. All these brain structures, these kinds of hormones and other brain chemicals that work in our brain are working in their brain, and that's where we got it from. And a lot of other animals do miss their companions. They have bonds for a reason. The bonds help them to survive or help their children to survive. And when a companion is suddenly gone, they are missed. The animals often alter their behavior. They don't eat in the same way or drink in the same way. They spend a lot of time looking for the one that is missing. Or in a few cases, in the case of elephants, for instance, they will they'll repeatedly revisit their bones. They'll feel the parts of the skeleton that were most familiar and most recognizable in life, like the tusks and the teeth. Elephants greet each other with their trunks. They put their trunks to each other's faces. They wrap around their tusks. They put their trunk in the other's mouth as sort of a kiss. And they know them that way, and they visit the bones that way, and it's very, very moving and very touching. But way, way down the evolutionary line from elephants, even birds sometimes show grief. We had a couple of ducks that were inseparable, and when one of them suddenly died, the other one spent weeks walking around calling and calling and calling and looking for it, and eventually she just kind of had to get on with life, and all of that different directed behavior, looking for her lost mate, eventually slowly stopped, and she started hanging around with our chickens. And you know, it was very touching. It was a lot like what people do. You lose someone that you love. For some people, you miss a couple of days of work, and you kind of back to it. For other people, you never get over it. It depends on what the relationship was, but you can see that reflected also in these other creatures.
What ultimately would you like us to take away from the book?
Well, that there are other forms of life on this planet with us that are part of our family, our living family. And if we open our minds and our hearts to them, they fill a hole that we never thought was there, we never realized was there. And they really enrich our lives, and we simply need to leave room for them on this planet, because they are who is at stake right now.
Carl Savina is the author of the new book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. The book is published by Henry Holt. Carl Savina, thank you very much for being with us and sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Great pleasure.
Appreciate it too.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.